You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a walk in that ribbon of highway, I saw above.
Hello and welcome to the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Ed and I had planned to do something special for the 100th episode of the podcast, but recent events have required that we do something less special and more serious than a rigorous bout of curling or horseshoes or whatever it was that we had planned. Instead, we're releasing this episode on the coronavirus. Obviously, I'm assuming all of our listeners know at least something about this, whatever they think about it. Everyone is aware that America is basically on shutdown. As of this record, we're recording Monday afternoon on, what is it, March 16th. There are just over 180,000 confirmed cases worldwide. There have been just over 7,000 deaths. That's about a 4% death rate. And about 80,000 people are confirmed as having recovered. China, Italy, Iran, and Spain have been hit hard in absolute numbers, although if we go as a percentage of the population, the worst nations are Italy, Switzerland, Norway, Sweden, and Iran. And of course, we've seen varied responses to this virus. Eastern Asian nations have gone into lockdown mode, with Singapore and Vietnam often being held up as the exemplary models of how to handle this kind of emergency. And on the other end of the spectrum, we have the United Kingdom that has announced that it will not be going into quarantine, but instead will work to protect the most vulnerable populations and spread out over time and space the infection rate to keep the crisis manageable. The phrase which Boris Johnson and the British National Health Service did not use, but which has come to be associated with them, is herd immunity. Closer to home, the United States has between 3,500 and 4,000 cases, depending on which sources you use. We've had confirmed cases in every state but West Virginia, and 73 people have died, or about a 2% death rate of confirmed cases so far. President Trump has declared a national state of emergency. 39 states have declared statewide states of emergency, and I don't know how many counties, cities, and school districts have done so as well. All of this to say, we need to think carefully and clearly about public health in a time of pandemic. And to help us do that, we have an expert in the field on the line. Joining us today is Jessica Harden, who has a master's in emerging infectious diseases and biohazardous threat agents from Georgetown University. That is, I assume you have a master's in all of those things that you got at Georgetown University, not that you study the ones that come from Georgetown University. She worked for years tracking epidemics, outbreaks, and civil trends through open source intelligence. I'm not entirely sure what all of that means, but maybe you can give us a little blurb. And today, she teaches art in the local classical school in South Carolina, where she lives with her husband and her two kids. Jessica, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Of course. Thank you for having me, Coyle. And thank you for having a podcast to talk about this. I think it's really essential that we kind of get some facts out there and just all start thinking about it, because unfortunately I fear that this is something that'll be here to stay with us for a little while. So with that being said, why don't we kind of start at the very beginning and talk about what a pandemic even means and what a coronavirus is and where this came from. So pandemic simply refers to the geographic spread of the virus. It says nothing of severity. So the WHO delayed declaring it a pandemic. Several sources kind of surmised that that was because they didn't want countries to stop battling the spread as hard as they were. So they feared that if they went ahead and declared it a pandemic, that people would either assume it was more severe and kind of call them for blowing it out of proportion, or that countries would stop fighting the spread and just assume that it was inevitable. So they recently did declare it a pandemic, which I think most of us could have looked at and said we felt it was already at pandemic stages. And then discussing coronaviruses, so the coronavirus family, these are lipid-enveloped viruses, and what that means is that it's easier to disrupt that lipid envelope, that fat envelope, than it is to, say, kill off norovirus, which is a notoriously difficult to kill virus. So for norovirus, you're going to need to have a high concentration of bleach, basically, for a period of time. So you need to visibly clean your surface and then bleach it into oblivion. Thankfully, coronavirus is a little bit easier to kill. So that's something that we have in our favor. You in your life, you have guaranteeably had a coronavirus. It's just that the majority of them cause common colds. So the difference that we have now, other coronaviruses that are not mild that you may have heard of include SARS and MERS. So SARS is severe acute respiratory syndrome and MERS is Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome. Both of those cause severe illness that is not as contagious person to person. MERS is actually acquired from camels, and the majority of person to person spread occurred in the nosocomial or hospital setting. So hospitals are unfortunately wonderful places to spread diseases because you do aerosol generating procedures like intubating patients. So when you do that, you're going to generate a bunch of aerosols, and the person who's doing the intubating becomes at high risk of becoming infected. The difference between COVID-19, which is technically known as SARS coronavirus 2 or SARS-CoV-2, the difference between it and original SARS and MERS is that it's a rather unique virus, and unique in a way that makes it unfortunately well-suited to cause a pandemic, because it is usually when you have, and this goes for influenza as well, when you have an infection like let's say H5N1, avian influenza, it binds deep in receptors in your lungs, and it causes a very terrible, severe pneumonia very quickly, and it can overwhelm your system really fast. But on the bright side, it doesn't necessarily cause as many upper respiratory symptoms, so the person is less likely to spread the disease on to other people in a casual setting. Now, what makes COVID-19 interesting is that our early research, and I would suggest and really encourage everyone to take all the numbers with a grain of salt, because we are early days in this outbreak. Even though it's 180,000 cases and undoubtedly more, it's still just a couple weeks in. And so there will be books that are written about this, and we are just not there yet. We don't have all the data in. So for anything that you hear data-wise, I think look for trends, not for exact numbers. So if you see a consistent trend across multiple countries, that's going to be more reliable than saying, oh, the fatality rate is XYZ. So it's easier to say, okay, it tends to be more fatal among these age groups, because we see that consistently across a couple different countries that are going to have different health systems and different comorbidities in their patients, in their natural populations. That's going to serve you better in terms of trying to get a picture than to try and say what the exact case fatality rate is. And I think with that, I've lost my train of thought.
Well, I that's okay. This will give me a good chance to ask an internet question. Facebook tells me that this is really just the flu, and we're all freaking out over nothing, and we should either just, you know, not worry about it because the odds are we're not going to get it anyway. Because even if a third of the population gets it, that's still, I have a 2/3 chance of not getting it. And again, the symptoms, they're not really that bad. So is Facebook wrong on this?
Facebook is wrong on this. So let's dive into that and address a couple different fronts. I remembered where I lost my train of thought. The first one, what's interesting about COVID-19 is that it infects deep in your lungs, but it is also highly transmissible. So somehow it is causing severe pneumonia symptoms, but it is still passing easily person to person. And that doesn't always happen with viruses. In fact, it's actually somewhat rare that it happens like this. I'm trying to think of similar ones that spread like this. So usually that bit of misinformation, and I've heard it a lot as well, is coming from, I think, hearing repeated statements of you're more likely to catch influenza than you are to get COVID-19. Now, you heard a lot of people making that statement early in the outbreak, I think as a way to reassure the population. Listen, if you're in Sheboygan, you're more likely to catch influenza than you are to catch COVID-19. And I think that the person delivering that understands the nuance that right now, today, with what we know, with the knowledge that we have, yes, you probably would have been more likely. And I'm going to put this in the past tense because I don't know that that's still an accurate phrase. You would have been more likely to catch influenza than COVID-19. But that is, our information, our knowledge is imperfect. And so I think what a lot of people heard was, oh, well, COVID-19 is no big deal. I didn't get the influenza. I didn't get influenza for the last 3 years, and I haven't even been vaccinated. So what's the big deal? So here's the big deal. Coyle, do you know what the fatality rate is for seasonal influenza? Average seasonal influenza. What's the fatality rate?
Prior to COVID-19, I probably wouldn't have.
Okay.
it's what, like 0.5% or 1% of people who get it? I mean, it's
less than that. It's actually 0.1%.
Because we have it's not a cure, but we have the treatment now, right? The Theraflu, whatever it's called.
Well, it's actually less about that, although I'm sure that helps in reduction. I'd have to actually go back and look at studies and see what the reduction based on Tamiflu is. But it actually has more to do with just the fact of the severity of the virus and of, just the severity of the virus and the fact that our bodies have some immunity to knowing other viruses that are somewhat similar to it. So with influenza, the difference between like a pandemic influenza year and just a usual seasonal influenza year, influenza mutates constantly. Each year it has what's called antigenic drift. It just shifts just a little bit, just enough so that, you know, you got it last year, but shoot, you get it in again this year. Every now and then you get something called antigenic shift, which is where you have a massive reassortment. And when that happens, absolutely nobody has immunity to it and it races through your population. So that's what happened with H1N1. Now, H1N1 was actually less fatal than regular seasonal influenza, which we didn't know when it first started racing around the globe. And so everyone was a little terrified that it was going to become something really 1918-ish. And then ended up being actually less than seasonal influenza. So I think a lot of us also think about H1N1. When we hear pandemic, we think, well, that was a pandemic and it was not even as bad as seasonal flu. So, Coyle, you mentioned in the introduction what the fatality rate has been, the average fatality rate. Do you mind repeating what the latest average number is?
I should point out that this is based off of my own internet research, so take it all for what it's worth. Worldwide, 180,000 cases, confirmed cases, and just over 7,000 deaths. So if I did my math right, that's about a 4% death rate.
Yeah.
And about 80,000 people that are confirmed as having recovered. Yeah. And then in the U.S., 3,500 to 4,000 cases, again, depending on what source you use, and 73 people have died, and again, about a 2% death rate.
Okay.
Of the confirmed cases so far.
So even if you have just a 1% fatality rate, that is 10 times higher than influenza. So usually what happens with outbreaks like this is we see a lot of what we think of as iceberg outbreaks. So you see the most severe cases first, and so you're going to see the cases that result in hospitalization and death first. So at the beginning of an outbreak, it can look more like it's more severe than it is. With COVID-19, this is especially tricky because we are hearing about asymptomatic cases as well. It's also tricky because we are barely, especially here in the U.S., it seems like we barely have the resources to test people who are severely ill, much less do any kind of surveillance to determine who out there might have been asymptomatic. So that makes it really tough to know what the actual fatality rate is. With that being said, Coyle, would you like to guess the difference? Would you like to guess what the fatality rate is for the 20 to 29-year-old bracket and for the, let's go to the 80 and up bracket? And this is based on a study of one of the first 50 to 70,000 patients in Wuhan, China. Okay, go.
So the 80 and up bracket, if I remember right, a week ago was 15%. I don't know if that's still the case or not, but that's the number I read. I have no idea what it is for the 20 to 29. Lower than that, I would guess, but again, I don't know what.
And it depends on the source that you look at, but it's more around seasonal influenza for that age group. And then for the under 20.
What about the most important age group, the 30 to 39?
The 30 to 39, it looks a little bit worse than influenza, but not dramatically so.
Okay.
And again, this is going to depend on the sources that you look at and the country that they are in. So I was going to pull up my numbers on Italy. So there's a source out of Italy, and this is...
Yeah, I did want to ask you about that, if you know anything about that. It seems like Italy is being hit especially hard, and I know nothing about Italian healthcare or disease, you know, raging through Italy. So if you have anything to say about that, I'd love to hear
it. Sure. So let me run through for those who are not familiar with the fatality rates there. You have in the 50 to 59 category, you've got 1% fatality rate. In the 60 to 69, you got a 3%. And the 70 to 79, a 10% fatality rate. And in 80 to 89, a 17%. 90 and above, it's 19%. Now, Coyle, some of what may be happening in Italy right now is that they became so overwhelmed so quickly that there are lots of anecdotal reports of a physician having to make that really difficult call of which patient do you put on the ventilator. And so I think I've even heard that at some point in time they simply told patients over a certain age that they should stay home and be made comfortable as opposed to coming in for extreme measures. And so I think some of their higher fatality rates on that older end may be due to less treatment. Now, what should concern us about that is that in the U.S., in any given state, county, municipality, there are a very limited number of ICU beds and of ventilators. So let's talk briefly about severity with COVID-19. So I'm sure you've heard of the 80% mild, 20% severe. So that 80% mild that's coming out of the initial batch of data coming from Wuhan, China. So that's going to include everything from asymptomatic cases all the way up to cases with pneumonia that did not require hospitalization. Once you crossed over into hospitalization, and usually that meant you needed oxygen, that's going to be your patients who were either on oxygen with severe pneumonia, shortness of breath, really struggling. And then that was about 14% of patients of that 20%. And then 6% were critical. So this is multi-organ failure, respiratory failure. These are your patients who are on ventilators that are requiring intensive support. So you can see how even if your outbreak doesn't appear to be that large, you know, here in South Carolina over the weekend, we only were up to 28 cases, and yet our schools are entirely closed. Why would they do that? That's because it doesn't take much in order for you to just totally overwhelm your healthcare system. And what can happen with a disease like this is if it is spreading wildly in your community, and if people in that 30 and under age group are getting it, and they're not even sure that that's what it is. You know, today I woke up with a slight cough and a sore throat and thought I might have had a low-grade fever. And, you know, it crossed my mind that if this was 2 weeks ago, I wouldn't have really thought anything of it. But being where we are right now, I'm going to be a lot more cautious, even though, you know, I don't fit the profile. And, you know, I would have a high fever and a cough. Those tend to be your two predominant symptoms. But, you know, again, it's a new disease. And so you can have a lot. What can happen is if you have a lot of community spread, and that's where people are not traveling in from infected areas, this is you go into a store, and you have a chat with the grocery cashier, and y'all end up kind of swapping droplets, essentially. And one of you is infected, but not yet symptomatic or asymptomatic entirely. Then you could end up infected, incubating for, you know, 2 to 14 days, and then sharing it again. And before you know it, you have a lot of people who have had it and spread it, but they didn't become sick enough to seek care. And so we don't actually have a really good epidemiological picture of what's happening until you start getting a huge surge of very severe cases. And by the time you have that, it's too late because it's very widespread in the community. So I'm going to pause because I don't just want to give you a big monologue and jump in. Next, I can dive into how I think we got into the place where we missed community spread, if that would be helpful. But do you have any questions?
First, can you tell us what community spread is?
Yeah.
And then talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So community spread is what usually happens when you catch a cold. Usually you don't think, I saw that Uncle Tom gave me his cold. Usually you just have no idea where you got that cold from, or your child comes home with a stomach bug and you have no idea where it came from. That is community spread. So it means that the disease is present enough in the local community that it has just spread from person to person and you're unaware. So here in South Carolina, we have we've had several cases in Kershaw County that have no known connection to each other. So that's highly suggestive of community spread. And usually when you find community spread in one area, it can, and again, I'm basing my experience on diseases in other countries and other diseases. But once you get community spread in one area, it becomes a lot easier for it to spread unnoticed to another. especially with a disease like this where you're not picking up every case. It just makes it a lot harder to do what we call contact tracing. So contact tracing is where, Coyle, if you get sick with, let's say, Ebola, it's actually a lot easier with something like Ebola. You get sick with Ebola and public health investigators are going to come to you. They're going to interview you. They're going to figure out all the places that you went, all the people that you talked to, and they're going to basically assign a level of risk to each of those people. And then they're going to go follow up with those people. And then they're going to follow them and they're going to trace those contacts and watch them for two incubation periods to kind of figure out exactly what's going on and if they are still at risk. And once they pass the incubation period, then they should be good to go. Usually you wait two full incubation periods with having no cases to say, okay, yes, we are safe, we're in the clear. So the incubation period for this disease is 2 to 14 days, with the average being about 5 days. So we will need to go 28 days without having any cases. So community spread, again, just to recap, is when it's just kind of spreading broadly in the community and it's not being imported. It has just become part of the disease background in the community and you're not sure where someone has gotten it from.
Now, based on my viewing of TV and movies, we have to sort of be able to find that initial patient in order to cure it. Is that true?
So that's a really great comment. Okay, so the initial patient is called the index. I'm thinking my brain's jumping all the way back to outbreak.
Patient zero, right? Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Outbreak.
Index case, patient zero. So what I was thinking about was the initial outbreak in Wuhan. The index case. So I'm sure you heard about the wet market, and wet markets are where you have live animals and dead animals all kind of mixed together, and it's a wet market because you have, well, it's like literally wet and you have lots of fluids that are swapping. So they're really, unfortunately, fabulous places for diseases from various species to mingle. And that's what makes them kind of really great environments for new diseases to pop out from. So initially we thought, and I'm using the we broadly here, initially the Chinese reported that all of the cases appear to be linked to this seafood market, this wet market. Unfortunately, the index case didn't have any connection, no known connection to that market or to any of the other patients. And that patient's wife became infected. So Dr. Dan Lucy, he was one of my professors at Georgetown. His comment on that was that it suggested that you either already had community spread at that point, and the virus had been going around for quite a while, or you had virus available at multiple points in the food chain. So maybe the index patient was infected over here and the rest of the patients were indeed infected at that market. So in terms of if you have to figure out the index patient zero, it's helpful because you can then kind of know where it came from and prevent additional spread if there's concern about the virus continuing to kind of splash from the animal population into the human population. The other thing that you can do, we can actually do really incredible things with genomic analysis right now. So they actually figured out, I think, that the virus must have made the jump from pangolins to humans. And pangolins are those crazy scaly creatures. I don't know if you've ever seen one. Kind of like, it looks like a little bit like an armadillo with scales instead of armor. That it made the jump probably, I mean, let's see, Dr. Lucy was suggesting that we might have had spread since October. I want to say someone else made the suggestion that genomic analysis suggested November. So somewhere around then. Now what that means is, again, knowing what we know about the virus and how it seems to be spreading, it's actually, pardon me, there's the cough that makes you paranoid. It's actually quite tricky to know if China, you know, by the time they caught their outbreak in Wuhan, if they were facing a similar situation as in Italy, where it simply had already kind of snowballed to a point where it was very hard to go ahead and contain it. And the way they had to contain it was to lock down the city of Wuhan entirely.
Is there anything else you want to say about community spread? Otherwise, we should, or anything else you want to say about the virus itself?
On the community spread, I want to point out that the role children play in this outbreak is still not understood fully. So they accounted for a very small percentage of the cases in Wuhan, in China. And there was initially some speculation that they were not affected at all, that they weren't infected. Later research suggested that they're infected at about the same rate as adults, but that they don't become severely sick, but they're still infected. And so therefore, Could they still spread the virus? If they can, how much can they still spread the virus? So that is some of the rationale behind why you close schools. Simply because if you have this potential, this population that may be potentially swapping the virus and you can't tell, that could actually be fueling the fire of an outbreak in an area without you knowing it. So again, I think a lot of the measures that you're seeing being taken right now are coming from a place of a lack of knowledge rather than an abundance of knowledge where you know exactly how to stop it or the things that you should or should not do. Unfortunately, we just don't have that. So we're left with really, really broad sweeping, rather crude measures to try and contain this.
Right. And these are measures that were developed based on past incidents that, the swine flu being the most recent one, that are, like you said, broad and supposed to be catch-alls and hopefully effective, but we'll see. I don't know if there's such a thing as a half-hearted effort that, if that's going to work anywhere, it'll work in America. Like if we can just really robustly, I may have to bleep myself on this, but if we can just robustly half something and get away with it, that's going to happen here. So,
I feel like America's outbreak could go one of two ways. So America has this like rugged individualism that you don't get in a lot of other countries. Now, that could really work against us if you see a lot. I don't know if you saw the picture. Someone tweeted it, Andrea Ocasio-Cortez, that she, so AOC had said, tweeted out, don't go to crowded restaurants, don't do these things, et cetera, et cetera. And this person wanted to kind of own the libs and replied back, like, I just ate a delicious burger at a crowded Red Robin and I took my time because I'm, it's America. I can do what I want. So I think right. That could be the ugly side of America's rugged individualism in trying to stop an outbreak. And that's where it actually is insufficient, perhaps necessary, but insufficient to do things like closing schools. Because if we close schools and then everybody just gets together and parties, that will defeat the purpose and it won't work. Then on the flip side of that rugged individualism, I think Americans very much have this sense of, I'm going to protect myself, my family, and my community. Yeah, the government's great and all, and there's a wonderful purpose for it, but it cannot do everything. And I need to look out for my neighbors. And so if I'm going to do that, I'm going to take this seriously. And even if it really stinks and my children are climbing the walls and we are coming up with all kinds of crazy games, I'm going to do what I have to do so that this thing stops with my family. I think that would be a positive outcome of America's culture on trying to stop an outbreak like this.
Well, and I could say more here. I have my own gut instincts on this, but they're probably wrong, and you're the expert. So, talk to us about containment. Like, how do you stop a pandemic, or can you? And do you just have to kind of ride it out?
Well, an outbreak stops when a virus no longer has a host to infect. Unfortunately, with COVID-19, no one has immunity to it, and a vaccine is very far off. So, a vaccine and talks of a vaccine is, it's really just happy talk that that would come out and stop the outbreak. So in the meantime, I think, before this started, and I've heard other people say this, there's one thought of like, well, if we're all going to get it, why don't you just go ahead and I'll get it? And then that way it's done. The problem with doing that is that I'm sure we've all seen the flatten the curve graphs. You overwhelm right. health systems really quite terribly. And that's bad for all of us, because if you need to have your gallbladder out and all of the staff at the hospital are completely consumed with trying to keep patients who are on the brink of death here with us, then it's going to be very difficult to free up staff in order to remove your gallbladder. Or if you have a tear in your retina and you need to go get it taken care of, it's going to be tricky to find an ophthalmologist who is both healthy and willing to stick his face in your face and to take care of it. So I think what people often miss with thinking about that strategy is the collateral damage that it would have on our society, not to mention the increased probably fatality rate and the depletion of healthcare resources. I mean, you'll put your healthcare providers at greater risk if we overwhelm the hospitals really fast. So that is one way, letting it just run through the population. But I think that would result in more loss of life, in more suffering, and in more pain. So the other strategy is to slow the spread so that you can manage it. Slow it down to a trickle so that you can have a patient come in severely ill, provide them the care that they need, put them on a ventilator, ECMO if possible. That's extracorporeal membrane perfusion, I think. Someone will write in and mention how I've gotten that wrong, and that is just fine. But basically, it's like a lung bypass. So it takes the blood out of your body, and it does the work of oxygenating your blood while it gives your virus-ravaged lungs time to heal. And places like Hong Kong and Japan and China have used these extensively to help really severe patients, but we don't have tons of them. And
your local family doctor does not have that in their office.
No, and in fact, I asked a nurse about our local hospital if they had one, and she was like, no. So you know, she doesn't work in the department that would work for them, but I generally would be surprised if our small little town had some of that advanced equipment. And in the absence of having that, you know, you will see more fatalities. So if you can slow it down, another trick with this is that I've seen somewhere that the average length of hospitalization for a COVID-19 patient is 28 days. That is a very long time to have a patient in a bed, absorbing a lot of resources. So Unfortunately, you really do have to slow that surge of patients down a good bit to prevent the types of negative effects that you don't want to see rippling across your society. So containment does come down to, unfortunately, with a disease like this, until we have a easily administered rapid test, that how wonderful, I mean, if you could have your nose swabbed before you walked into school and know that you are indeed negative and you are not shedding virus at this point, then you could go into school, into a restaurant, into church, and you could participate. Absent that, then we are left in a situation where we do have to do strict social distancing, unless further research comes out and we figure out exactly how this spreads and the role of different groups. And it's interesting to think about the UK's strategy, because I have argued that strategy is insufficient, that just protecting the vulnerable and focusing your efforts on just kind of walling them off, that doesn't help when they need things like routine medical care, or they're still going to need groceries. And so you're basically asking them to just like lock themselves away until this is all over, and use herd immunity. I mean, time will tell. There's all sorts of different strategies out there. South Korea has gone the opposite way of the US, where in the US we've said, lay people, please stop hoarding masks, save them for the healthcare workers. In South Korea, they've said, everybody has a mask, and they want everyone to have one whenever they leave the house, with the thinking being that masks are more effective at preventing me from spraying my droplets onto you than they are at protecting you from inhaling infectious droplets. So we're going to have lots of different case studies to study and see what actually is more beneficial and effective.
The mask has the effect of reminding you that this is a thing while you're out and about too.
Yeah.
Like even if it does nothing whatsoever to prevent the spread of it, ultimately, at least you remember that you're supposed to be trying.
Yeah. And it also really prevents you from touching your face.
Well, that's fair.
Half of it is covered. So it really does help in that regard.
Touching my face right now.
It's incredibly difficult not to touch your face. It's really quite funny how difficult it is to change your behavior, which, I mean, gets back to what we are asking people to do is incredibly hard to do. We're asking a very social species to not be social for a while. And we're asking our economy to find ways to survive without having face-to-face interactions. And that's really challenging. I was just speaking with someone today who she has her own speech therapy clinic, and she has speech therapy and occupational therapy. And she's learned that insurers will not cover teletherapy, but she's concerned about having, you know, her young children patients come through and potentially spread the virus between themselves and the therapist and be a broader, you know, introducing the virus into broader populations. And so it's interesting that you have health insurers who would, you would think, have a vested interest in preventing the broader spread of the virus, having them say, no, this isn't related to COVID-19. We're too overwhelmed to deal with approving teletherapy. It's interesting that that's the response that they're taking. And I think as this wears on, we will have to find ways to do things like that, so that, you know, some of these children, if they don't receive that therapy, they will stop eating and they'll stop talking and they'll regress in being able to walk. So these are not just, this is not a matter of a child wanting to go to a trampoline park. This is a matter of a parent having invested, you know, a significant amount of time and money in improving their child's well-being and seeing those gains vanish. So there are, I mean, there are real life costs and consequences to doing this type of social distancing. And it is challenging. I don't know. Has your family faced any of those challenges?
Well, I am married to an introvert, and both of my kids are. One of my kids is definitely an introvert, and the other one is kind of right on the bubble. So no, not yet. We're also in, you know, day five or whatever of the lockdown. So no, at this point we're fine. We've basically said we're going to stay home as much as we can. We also live in a part of the country where we have parks we can go for a walk in, and then, yeah, I suppose maybe everyone else will have that idea, and then we'll have to stay away. But there are things to do that do not involve being in huge crowds.
Yeah.
And so both psychologically and culturally, where we're at, it's fine. I assume where you guys live, it's very similar.
It is, and I think that introversion is a bit of a superhero power, a superpower right now for surviving a pandemic. I'm married to someone who travels for a living and speaks to large crowds, so that is definitely a change for us.
Yeah, doing that electronically is not the same thing.
No, doesn't work quite the same. Same with teaching art. Teaching art is not exactly the easiest thing to do, although we're going to test it out. We'll see if we can come up with some ways. I was trying to think of if there was something else. Treatment-wise, we don't have any solid information on treatment for the virus. I suspect that as more case studies come out, and that's where clinicians share their experience of how they treated severe patients, I think you'll see different protocols emerging for ways that you can help these patients. And hopefully that results in a lower fatality rate. I think a large concern that I have is the protection of our healthcare providers. So it takes many years to get into the healthcare field, lots of training. That training means advanced age. And so we have a disease that is targeting, it's not targeting actually, that's an incorrect way of putting it, that has more severe outcomes for those who are older. And that's actually a really key point to emphasize. So, you know, children can be infected, 20-somethings can be infected, we can all be infected, but those who are more at risk of more severe outcomes are those who are older or who have underlying health conditions. So with that being said, I'm concerned that if this drags on for a while, you just have, you know, some of our most educated members of our society that we really rely on during everyday life are going to be put at risk over and over again. And it's not like we can call on the country that's not affected to lend us some of their personal protective equipment. So I think that's a real challenge for our nation and for other nations around the world.
Sure. Anything else you want to say? Otherwise, I'll have kind of a closing question for you.
I just have one last thing to point out.
Go for it.
One thing to watch is, because this is not, you know, this is not an apocalyptic pandemic where we're going to all get it and die from it. This is a pandemic that has the potential to cause mass disruption in our society and a lot of death, but that will be centered in the older ages. And because of that, I think countries who have populations like ours, with a boomer population, where you have a smaller base of young people and a larger base of old people, they will be disproportionately more affected versus a country like India, where your demographics are kind of flipped and you have a larger young population, a smaller older population. So I think, you know, that's just something to watch when you see the outbreak unfold, just to see. I suspect that will hold true, but I think continuing to watch that. And final note, I would just encourage everyone that is listening to this, that we all, thankfully, we live in a nation of individuals that are highly talented and highly entrepreneurial. And so I think over the next couple of weeks and months, we may see challenges and problems in our community, and some of the best solutions to various public health problems and not public health problems have come from people just seeing a problem and applying their talents to solve it. So if I could just kind of urge people who are out there to look at what's going on around them, and to, even if you're stuck at home, find a way to kind of support the community around, I think that will benefit our society on the whole. kind of a little outside of my scope, but that definitely is something that we've seen play out from other outbreaks.
No, I think you're right. I mean, we will be seeing new toilet paper factories opening left and right.
That is correct.
So I guess you've kind of done that. So if you want to sit on that, that's fine. I was going to ask you to give us the good news the good news of the pandemic.
I mean, I think the good news of the there's a little bit more good news. I think this is a great time for you to get to know your neighbors. Okay, get to know them from 6 feet away.
From a distance, yeah.
From a distance. But, you know, find those, like in our neighborhood, we want to identify those people who feel vulnerable and pair them up with people who do not feel vulnerable. And everything from delivering groceries to checking in on them when they're sick to even wheeling their trash cans down to the bottom of the street just so that they don't have to, you know, grab a hold of something that someone else is grabbing a hold of. Just even in little things like that, making them feel more connected. If you think about the older population, you know, if it spreads widely, they're more likely to see more of their friends pass away more quickly. And so it would not hurt for us to already be building up those intergenerational relationships so that we can kind of weather the next storm better. And support those around us who are going to be more vulnerable or suffer more during this time. And I think that and having entrepreneurial individuals solving the problems that they see in front of us, I think that makes us a more resilient society that is a better place to live and turns into a better place for our children. So that's my hopeful end.
Well, and that is a great place for us to end. I suspect this won't be our last episode on the coronavirus. I need to consult with Ed further on this, but I think we'll probably have at least one on the public health side of things coming down the road. And Jessica, we may be asking you to join us on that also, probably one on what the government's doing in all of this also. But again, we're still thinking about what we want this to look like. So with that said, thank you, Jessica, for joining us, and thank you, listener, for joining us as well. City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filipic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family. Get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org, where you can listen to episodes. I should have mentioned this, that you've been on, right, Jessica? You were on the Christian Feminist show, talking not about this issue specifically. Vaccinations? Was that the one you were
talking
on?
Talking about how Christians should think about healthcare. And
there we go.
How Christians should think about beauty. So check them out.
Right.
It's 92 and 93, or 91 and 93.
I'll take your word for that. please leave us a review on iTunes. Help other people find our show. Like our Facebook page, and get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.